from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. It's lonely at the top, they say, and that's how it can feel for Americans when it comes to this country's place in the world. One minute, we're the exceptional nation, the only country with the might and the right stuff to make the world a better place. The next, we're wondering if we've still got all that and how best to use it at home, abroad. We're getting ready to choose a new president. My guest, Ian Bremmer, says it's time to decide on a clear global strategy. And you need to do it. This hour on Point, America's way in the world now, from Ramadi to China to the home front. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is it time to be large and in charge, or to get our own house in order? Do we have to choose? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, we will listen to British author Ian McEwan's words of wisdom on freedom of expression for the graduating class at Dickinson College this weekend. But first, to the world and America's role in it. Very much on the mind and tongue of South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham just today. Not officially running for the presidency yet, says he may do that on June 1st. But with CBS This Morning, he says the world's a mess.
I'm running because I think the world is falling apart. I've been more right than wrong on foreign policy. It's my ability in my own mind to be a good commander-in-chief and to make Washington work.
He's not the only one talking about it, thinking about it. Here's Senator Marco Rubio last week at the Council on Foreign Relations.
President Kennedy, like most presidents before and since, understood what I believe our current president does not, that American strength is a means of preventing war, not promoting it, and that weakness, on the other hand, is the friend of danger and the enemy of peace.
And here's Rand Paul. This was last month in New Hampshire, saying, yes, have American power, but be very cautious in how you execute, how you put it out there in the world. Case in point, the 2011 military intervention in Libya didn't secure Libya for its people. He says, worse, says Paul, jihadists swim in our swimming pool now.
The other Republicans will criticize the president and Hillary Clinton for their foreign policy, but they would have just done the same thing just 10 times over. Every one of the ones who will criticize me wanted troops on the ground, our troops on the ground in Libya. I think it was a mistake to be in Libya. We are less safe. We should have never been there.
What's the way forward for America and the world? Joining me now from New York is Ian Bremmer, president and founder of Eurasia Group, a political risk and consulting firm. His new book is Superpower: Three Choices for America's Role in the World. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Ian Bremmer, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, thanks for having me back.
Before we dive into your big thesis, can we just look at a couple world events right now? Ramadi falling to the Islamic State over the weekend. Seems only a couple months ago, the Pentagon was planning to take back Mosul. Now, instead, we're losing the latest city, this one only 70, 80 miles from Baghdad. What do you see in this advance, Ian?
We said we were going to have it by spring.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's the Arab Spring, which doesn't go the way we expect. There's no question. It's very clear that the Americans can say as much as we want in this region. We want Assad must go. ISIS must be defeated. And someone else must do most of the work, and we haven't identified who they are. And so, therefore, the outcomes are 4 million Syrian refugees, 11 million displaced, 250,000 dead, the strongest terrorist organizations that we've seen in the history of the planet. And a day after we announce a successful bombing raid to take out one of the ISIS operatives, we have we have one of the more important cities in Iraq falling to that very same organization. No one can look at what's happening in the Middle East or many parts of the world and say they feel comforted with the direction of global security and the geopolitical order.
Do we get a permanent caliphate here if the U.S. does not go back in? Or does it naturally somehow get eaten away and dissipated?
I don't think we do, because to maintain a caliphate requires governance and cash, and you know they don't have the oil money. The oil that's been mostly destroyed. Those pipelines and capacity to develop. No one's paying them ransoms anymore. The Saudis and the Qataris are no longer writing checks informally. They probably got over $1 billion when they took over those banks in Mosul, mm-hmm. and that's not going to happen again. So their ability to actually govern as a coherent caliphate, I don't see. But the ability of the Islamic State to, as an organization, to attract all sorts of mostly disenfranchised young men, particularly in the Middle East, but also in Europe and in Russia. And even in some other parts of the world, though much less, that's going to grow considerably, and there's no strategy to really respond to that.
I want to look at your big thesis and your big questions, but spin the globe once more for us before we do. China, news over the weekend that they are taking their nuclear missiles and putting multiple warheads on them now, mini warheads. Of course, when you have more than one warhead on a missile, it's much more difficult to think about how to counteract it if it were ever launched. And the interpretation here is that this is a message for the United States. What's the message, Ian Bremmer?
The more direct message might be the one the Chinese have been sending with the Russians yesterday, the first time those two states have ever joined up for military exercises in the Mediterranean. And I don't think it's to help with the refugee crisis. It's to project strength. The Brits, America's special relationship, despite American protestations, decided that they were going to join the China-led Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank just last month. Mm-hmm. The Americans said they were pandering. The Brits were pandering to the Chinese. They became a founding member. It's a direct competitor to the U.S.-led World Bank. All of these messages very clearly is that the U.S. is not in decline. I don't think we are at all. But American foreign policy influence is. And globalization is getting stronger and stronger, but Americanization is not. It's eroding. And it is the absence of an American foreign policy strategy, which we thought we could get away with after the Soviet Union collapsed. But increasingly, we can't. And the fact that you have presidential candidates actually deciding they're going to get on the basis of their foreign policy expertise, that shows you how bad it is, because this is a country that doesn't care about this sort of stuff. And we're being made to care.
You say, I want to come to that, you raise different paths for us. You say the American people ultimately are going to have to decide there. I guess it'll be decided for them if they don't, but you've got enough faith in democracy to say, come on, people, let's decide. Set the table for us, the big context. You write in the death that we're at a moment where the death of the existing order and the violent birth of a new one create extraordinary turmoil. You say this is one of those moments. What's the existing order that's passing? What's being born?
The order that's passing is the one that the Americans created after World War II. It's the last time that the world really experienced what I call geopolitical creative destruction. America was the only country left standing. We rebuilt the Europeans with the Marshall Plan. We spent 4% of our GDP to do it. Imagine even thinking of something like that today. It's inconceivable. We rebuilt Japan. General MacArthur, also in our image, created stronger democracies and free market economies that ultimately would build the international institutions that would determine the path that globalization would take over more than half a century, whether it's the United Nations or the World Bank or the IMF. The World Trade Organization. That was the last time this happened. It's happening again, and it's happening again now precisely because the United States, we no longer know the kind of role we want to have in the world. And there are lots of other – our allies are much weaker than they used to be, and they're hedging an awful lot more. And we've talked about that already a bit. And there are other countries in the world that really dislike what America has stand for historically and are willing to take us on. And that's true in a more overt and destructive and assertive way in the case of Putin's Russia. And it's true in a much more long-term and strategic way in terms of the world's second largest, soon to be largest economy, China. And the final thing I'd say here is this. There's really only one country in the world right now with a global strategy. And it's China. And that should unnerve American voters.
I want to look at exactly how you see that strategy. America's strategy, or lack thereof, is foremost on your mind here. You say we've been playing it ad hoc for quite a while now. You say we need to choose. We need to choose how we want to, the role we want to play in the world. And you've got three paths. We're going to dig into each of them. You make the argument compellingly for each of them, and then you choose one. You say everyone's going to have to choose if we want to get this right. In thumbnail, lay out the three paths for us. We got a break in a couple of minutes here, but before we get to it, let us understand the three paths you say look like the alternatives in front of us now.
Sure. Well, the first is the one that most will be used to, indispensable America, and that's the idea that we may not want to be the world's policeman, but it's very clear no one else is remotely capable of doing it. And if the world continues to deteriorate, that's going to hurt us, not just everybody else. And so we have to promote not only peace and security around the world, but also values that really matter, human rights, free markets, and democracy. And that's true whether it's talking about how the Chinese need to govern, whether it's really trying to put the Russians in a box, or whether it's responding to the atrocities that we see every day across so many states in the Middle East. The second choice, what I call Moneyball America from Michael Lewis's book that talked about the Oakland A's. And that basically says, look, we're going to be much more focused on the bottom line. We're not promoting democracy all over the world because most countries don't want to hear it. We're not promoting the free market all over the world because the Chinese, when they become the largest, don't accept it. What we're going to do is really make the bets with the resources we have that are going to play out the best for us. So that means, for example, a real pivot to Asia, where you pivot to Asia because they're the most important economically and strategically. You pivot away from other things. If NATO allies aren't going to pay, you're not going to pay as much attention to them. If the Israelis and the Palestinians refuse to talk about a peace plan, we're not going to force them.
Pick your battles very carefully. Give us the third. We'll take a break and come back and look at all of them. The third way?
The third is independent, and independent says that values are really important, but not abroad at home. The United States has to live up to them and lead by example, that all the problems we've been talking about, whether it's Russia into Ukraine, whether it's terrorism in the Middle East, they are much bigger problems for other countries in the world than they are for the Americans, and we have to start living that way.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about America's way in the world now, from Ramadi to China to the home front, where we really need to put our effort for a good future. Ian Bremmer is with us, president, founder of Eurasia Group. It's a political risk and consulting firm, very sharp observer of the world thinker. His new book is Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. And he says, really, the 2016 campaign is the time to decide. We can't put it off. We've been sort of running ad hoc in the world. And American voters need to get their heads around the options in front of us. He wants to help us, you, do that. Me too. There are big new players out there. The leaders of China and India meeting just in the last few days, Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi meeting in Xi's hometown of Xi'an in China, also famous for its terracotta warriors. During that visit, the two countries signed a couple dozen agreements on everything from mining to space to yoga. Here's Xi Jinping.
This is the first time that I have hosted a foreign leader here in my hometown. I'm very pleased to welcome you here, and I hope you enjoy your visit.
First foreign leader to his hometown, the leader of, not the United States, India. U.S. role in the world? Here's a taste of where it's been. This is a 2012 recruiting ad for the Marine Corps titled Toward the Sound of Chaos. To Ian Bremmer, this ad perfectly captures a kind of superhero idea of America that influences a lot of our foreign policy decisions.
There are a few who move toward the sounds of chaos, ready to respond at a moment's notice. And when the time comes, they are the first to move toward the sounds of tyranny, injustice, and despair.
Sheesh, that's the sound of recruiting for the Marines. Should that be the way for the USA? And here, the president himself on this subject, May, just about a year ago, at West Point. And the U.S. has to be careful about how it uses its power. President Obama.
America must always lead on the world stage. If we don't, no one else will. The military that you have joined is and always will be the backbone of that leadership. But U.S. military action cannot be the only or even primary component of our leadership in every instance. Just because we have the best hammer does not mean that every problem is a nail.
Ian Bremmer in New York, author of the new book, Superpower. Hasn't this president tried not to just be one of these, not just to be the old large and in charge, dominate the world president? Is he kind of a piece of what you're asking for here or not?
There's no question that President Obama has tried to move away from the notion that the United States is the world's policeman. That is, having said that, very different from the idea that there's some other conception of what the United States should be and what we should do. I think one of the biggest problems that Obama has experienced has been a big disconnect between what he's said and the actions we've seen on the ground. You look at the red lines in Syria, where we said repeatedly, you are absolutely not going to use chemical weapons. And it's like, no. What we meant was systematically use chemical weapons. And then we said, well, actually, it was systematically use chemical weapons if our allies in Europe support us. Not the French. We need the Brits too.
Yeah.
And then, well, only if Congress actually votes in favor of it. And then, well, maybe the Russians will help us out. We've seen this again in Russia, Ukraine. Russia, we're going to isolate you. We're going to punish you if you don't behave the way we want. And for the better part of 15 months now, the Russians have chosen or else. They'd prefer else. And some of our developed market friends have supported us, but most of the emerging markets in the world have all supported Russia. There have been no consequences of that. So there's been enormous incoherence from U.S. foreign policy. And if you talk to any foreign minister around the world, including those of all of our allies, they'll tell you, we don't know what you guys stand for. What do you want? And we don't know how committed you are to us. Which is why you have a summit. Obama hosts a summit last week with all the Gulf state heads of state. And a week beforehand, four of the six say, actually, we're not coming. That's never happened before.
I can imagine Barack Obama saying, hey, Ian, the world is complicated. You want to choose one way of the three that you lay out here, but new stuff comes up all the time. We've got to respond to it. We can't choose one strategy here. We've got to be diverse and ready to roll. Why the necessity of choosing?
I love the fact that – so I remember Susan Rice, our national security advisor, who got a lot of complaints from the media that they took so long in putting out their strategy document and came out just in October, I guess it was. And the actual quote from her was, well, if we had put out the strategy in February or April or July, she said, it would have been overtaken by events 2 weeks later in any one of those months. In other words, you can't have a strategy because the strategy would be overtaken by events. You know what? I wrote a book that wasn't overtaken by events. I had to do that a year ago. They can come up with a strategy. We're the world's largest country. We're the world's superpower. We can't have a strategy. Strategy doesn't mean that you don't adapt when things happen in the world that aren't according to plan. It means you have a purpose. You have a mission. Do our values matter or not abroad? Does democracy matter or not? How much do we care about our existing alliances? Who are we committed to? What are the kinds of things that matter to us around the world? We've had a strategy. When the Soviet Union existed, after World War II, when we created the present world order, we had a strategy. Today, same world, China has a strategy. We don't have one. We've abdicated. And I think that that's not just been an Obama problem. It's been a problem for presidents over the last 25 years, for Bush, for Clinton, and now for Obama. The problem is that the consequences are getting much greater because the world is becoming much more complicated and unforgiving.
We'll dive back into America's decision. What's China's strategy?
China's strategy is twofold globally. The first is that they recognize that the U.S. is going to have the largest military that they can't challenge around the world. And even in their backyard, they don't want to directly challenge American allies too much because it will lead to backlash against them. But economically, they do want to actually assert themselves against the U.S.-led world order. And they want to spend over $1 trillion in building architecture and in building infrastructure with countries both around them in Asia and much more far-flung to orient them towards China, orient them towards supporting Chinese state-owned enterprises and privately owned national champions.
We're going to talk right here tomorrow about the new rail line China wants to put in across South America while ours are falling apart.
That's right. And, I mean, the rail lines, the port facilities. I was recently with the former Singaporean foreign minister who said, Americans shouldn't worry about this because if they build a rail line, you can use it just like the Chinese. Who doesn't like rail? Okay. And I said, well, you know, it's kind of funny. It's like the IMF. When the IMF provides support for development to get women educated, who wouldn't want that? The point is, though, when America through the IMF gives money to a country, in return, they say, well, you've got to become more like us. You have to become more democratic. You have to reform your economy in ways that our companies will be able to work more effectively. When the Chinese give $1 trillion, and no one else is spending anything like this, they say, we want you to be closer to our internet. We want you to be closer to our telecom standards. We want you to do more business with in our currency, in our RMB. And we want you to work more closely for the long term with our state-owned enterprises. That is a global economic strategy. And they're the only country in the world that actually has one right now.
Okay, if we have to choose one, and you put three out there, maybe our listeners have others, we'll turn to them as well, but you've got the indispensable America, kind of global cop and values promoter as one. You've got the Moneyball approach, sort of pick your shots, very strategic interventions. And then you've got the one you call sort of, you call it the independent path. It's kind of a come home America, or lead, get your own house in order, lead by example from the home front first. Take us to the first one. Marco Rubio laid out his foreign policy vision recently, and it sounded to me a little bit like the indispensable America rule. What are the pros and cons of that approach?
Well, the pros of the indispensable is that we've done it for a long time. We know how. It's a role that many of our allies really want us to have. You look to the Saudis or the Israelis or the Canadians. Japan, certainly many of our Asian allies are saying, where are you guys? You know, we want a much more robust American engagement. And it also involves American values that we do think matter. And it's hard for Americans to just sit by and watch while we have millions killed and refugees and we're not really doing anything about it. It's hard to watch ISIS do well. So, you know, indispensable allows you to respond to that. The downside to indispensable is it's really, really costly, and it's getting much harder to affect. You know, I mean, John McCain, God love him, wants to bomb a lot of countries, right? But he doesn't want to put American boots on the ground in Syria. He's not suggesting that we actually do the kinds of things that would actually remove Assad and would create a democracy out of Syria over the long term. It's the amount of economic commitment, the amount of damage that has to be taken in order to get these things done. I mean, Russia-Ukraine, I see Lindsey Graham saying we need to provide weapons to the Ukrainians. Just giving weapons to the Ukrainians, the Russians are likely to escalate. The Americans would have to do a lot more than that. We'd have to ramp up sanctions to really hurt the Russian economy.
So part of it is maybe we just can't afford it.
The downside is if we're going to do it, I mean, it's easy to talk indispensable. Mm-hmm. It's easy to run an election campaign on the basis of indispensable, wrap yourself in the flag. But actually going ahead and doing it is becoming much, much harder and more costly than it used to be, especially because America's allies are actually weaker and less oriented towards doing this than they have been historically. So the lift is a lot greater than you would have thought, you know, sort of in the days of the Cold War.
Moneyball, the pick-your-shots approach, pros and cons. Sounds like Libya.
Pros and cons from Moneyball. Does sound like Libya. Of course, Libya still fell apart. Mm-hmm. Pros from Moneyball is that it's pretty easy everyone else does Moneyball, right? Moneyball is kind of like America's like other countries. France does Moneyball, right? Japan does Moneyball.
Very cautious about when they get engaged.
When they get engaged and doing it to really support their own economy. And China is doing Moneyball. So the Americans saying, well, look, if everyone else is going to do it, we should do it. And we understand that, you know, the Europeans don't want to pay a lot for NATO. Well, you know, how important is defending Italy these days? And Ukraine is not an ally of the United States, and it's bad that Ukraine is falling apart. But we've had bad things happen even during the Cold War. We had the genocide in Rwanda. We didn't really follow up on that.
So values, schmalus. You're not going to go out and try and plant democracy everywhere. It's too expensive. You pick your shots with a kind of economic filter.
Yeah, run the country like a company, right? I mean, we know how to run companies. We've got the biggest companies in the world. Why can't the U.S. government be a little bit more effective and judicious in what they actually do and stop trying to tell everybody how they need to run their countries? The days for that are well over.
Then you've got independent. And for some Americans, this will harken all the way back to George McGovern's Come Home, America. But There's some version of that here. What exactly are you suggesting? How far can we take this? It's a globalized world, and we all hear it.
It's a globalized world. Independent means the United States is distinctly not isolationist, but it also means that the U.S. isn't going to solve everybody else's problems. So you can have lots of free trade with independent, and you can even do things that really do inspire. I mean, it's interesting that as at the same time American foreign policy influence has gone down so much, Chinese all want to send their kids to American universities. They all want to buy real estate in Boston, New York, Seattle, you
yep,
name it.
Yep.
And the American markets are hitting record levels today. So, you know, clearly America is not doing everything wrong. The problem is that a lot of what America sort of is talking about outside the country, they aren't necessarily standing up to internally. And so they need to do a better job of that. And that, by the way, includes things like accepting refugees. I mean, 4 million refugees from Syria, 355 accepted by the United States, not a single candidate for 2016 talking about it. It's almost as if the Statue of Liberty doesn't exist. Like no one ever wrote anything on the side of it, and then none of our parents actually came from these countries themselves. Downside for independent, of course, is that if the United States really is doing a lot less, a lot of these problems are going to fester, and the ability and willingness of other countries to step up, you'd like to believe it's there, but you know, common experience has told you it really isn't.
Choices to be made. Ian Bremmer is with us. His new book is Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World. And he says we really have to make a choice. 2016, the time to do it. Terry in Oklahoma City is calling. Hi, Terry. You're on the air with Ian Bremmer.
Hey, great discussion. Really appreciate the refreshing point of view of your speaker. Listen, I've been very alarmed as an amateur historian about our ability to pick the wrong people to get in bed with after World War II, from, you know, Kennedy and LBJ cozying up with the folks in South Vietnam who were, you know, terrible allies who really ended up indirectly allowing us to escalate and have 50,000 American boys dead, to many other regimes. And obviously it was because we were scared to death about communism after World War II, and we had to sleep with these dictators, for whatever it's worth. And now we're sleeping with new dictators, and that's the Shia and Sunni people in the breakup of, you know, the old Iraq empire that was put together by the Ottomans.
So what's the answer, Terry, to choose better or to pull back?
Well, yeah, I'm just amazed with our wonderful, intelligent people in Washington, D.C., that want to cozy up with some of the wrong people. For example, my last point is the Shiites and the Sunnis have been at each other's throat for 1,300 years. That's a classic civil war. And McCain's out of his bloody mind to put anybody in, boots on the ground, and go in there and have our boys fight between those two. And it's also indirectly helping Iran, the Shiite thing.
Yeah, no, we've seen that. Terry, it's hard to choose. I want to get one more before the break. We've chose poorly, you say. One more. Thank you, Terry. Alex in Cambridge, Massachusetts, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Ian. Yes, I think at the base, we're missing a little something. The American public is most of the time angry at Congress, afraid of terrorists. We're angry, afraid. We are not trustful of the government. The government is unable to govern. The Democrats are like moderate Republicans. The Republicans are off the charts. So I think you have to start there. We sort of lack the courage of our original convictions, as I think Mr. Bremmer is pointing out. You know, it's not that I don't like war. I don't like killing. I don't think that we should, that any of us should be doing that. However, if you're going to say we are the greatest country on earth all the time and may God bless America, then you have to sort of live up to that. We are unable to do that under these circumstances.
Alex, we'll pick it up after a break. Terry, Alex, thanks for your calls. Ian Bremmer's new book is Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Hi, this is Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for listening. Audible.com is our sponsor today. Audible.com carries over 180,000 book titles, plus magazines and newspapers. Many of the books we talk about on the show can be downloaded and listened to whenever, wherever you want. And as an incentive to get you to try this service, they're offering On Point listeners a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/onpoint, download a free title, and listen. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/onpoint. That's audible.com/onpoint to get started today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about America's way in the world, from Ramadi to China to the home front, where we really need to put our effort for a good future. Ian Bremmer is with us. His new book is Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World. You can join us. Time to choose, he says. Indispensable America, large and in charge. We know that role well. Moneyball America, really picking our shots abroad with economic benefit for the country in mind. Independent America, a much more get our own house in order, lead by example approach. Ian, response online here. Shansi says, middle class can't afford to fix other countries, and the rich refuse to pay more. Time to give up the global cop role. Mark says, I personally think we need a combination of Bremmer's option 2, Moneyball, and 3, kind of bring it home, independent, in order to continue to be successful, a global player. And Mangan says, it's not clear why there needs to be 3 options. 2 and 3 don't seem mutually exclusive, or is 3 supposed essentially to be isolationism? Is that what you mean by bring it home, Ian?
No. I think that the main difference is between 2 and 3. 2 is taking some really large bets. It means 2 will actually – you'll still see a fairly indispensable role. It just won't have American values attached to it. It'll have American interests, particularly in Asia, and also picking spots as those crises seem to be large. So, I mean, you could certainly imagine the Americans, if they believe that Gaddafi needed to be removed in option 2, Moneyball, you'd remove him. Option 3, if the Middle East and the Europeans aren't going to do it themselves, the Americans wouldn't be. You make arguments along those lines all over the world. And the other point is that option 3 really does focus on what American values are all about. It's not really – I guess the way I would put it is –
Living them at home.
Living them at home. I mean, indispensable America is really essentially a vote with your heart. Moneyball America is essentially a vote with your wallet. An independent America is essentially a vote with your brain. And those three things have always been difficult for us to unpack. You'd like to be able to pick all three, and the point is that the world we're in right now really doesn't allow that.
I was kind of blown away. Ian Bremmer, in the end, I'll take the mystery cloud away here. Ian Bremmer chooses 3. Ian Bremmer, the big internationalist, the global strategist, the guy who advises on everything going on abroad, he says bring it home, even at a cost to American certain substantial kinds of American presence and even alliances abroad. We'll look at why. A couple calls first. Amit in Coralville, Iowa. Amit, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much. I would like to comment on the great humanitarian support that the United States is doing in Nepal. We suffered a devastating 7.8 earthquake in the wake of that. United States aid and Fairfax County DART team and plus U.S. Marines has done an incredible job there. They have put their life in danger in saving people's life and also bringing life back to normal. So I'm really thankful for U.S. generosity, and I am proud of the world we are living in, and I'm just very thankful.
Amit, we've got it. That's a very interesting observation to make right here, and I'll take it to Ian. All right, Ian, you're for option 3, independent, bring it home. Amit says, thank you very much for helping after the quake in Nepal. Would the U.S. still be doing that under your choice, Ian?
It's not clear it would be doing as much international on the humanitarian side. I think it would be doing a lot more in terms of trying to ensure that the Americans were living up to those sorts of issues at home. And the U.S. would also be very open in terms of both immigration, in terms of trade, in terms of trying to provide the kind of values with the world's largest economy that would want – that would lead a lot of other countries to live up to that. If you ask me, I mean, I looked at China had a much more vigorous response, as did India, to Nepal after the earthquake than they ever had historically. And we're seeing that in lots of countries around the world, that over time you are going to have a much larger local and regional response. So I guess the question is, if you want a strategy – that strategy is one that has to live not for a year or 2 years or 5. It has to live for 20, for 30. It has to really be what America is all about.
And let China be the savior. Let India be the savior when Nepal quakes?
I think the reality is that when China becomes the largest economy in the world, they're likely to be doing so much more that, I mean, in 10 years' time, if China doesn't fall apart, and I wouldn't bet on that, South Korea's relationship with China is going to look a lot like Mexico's relationship with the United States.
Wow.
It is objectively hard to understand how the American people will be behind providing the kind of support for a South Korea in that kind of an environment when the politics in those countries are so much more aligned and the economies are so much more aligned to another country entirely.
John in Austin, Texas. You're on with Ian Bremmer, John.
Hi, Tom and Ian. Ball for option two for a long time. And the result is that we're now locked into treaty relationships and alliances with countries like Israel, with Saudi Arabia, with India, with various other countries around the world that leaves us in an incoherent position for the modern time. These are all historical relationships, and either we break out of them and we just declare, okay, we're abandoning this alliance, or we stay with an incoherent policy. We don't have a choice on that.
Our time grows short. Let me take it to Ian Bremmer. Ian, are you saying you say bring it home. You say take the independent path, lead by example with a very strong economy and democracy at home. What does that mean for alliances with, John mentions Israel, Saudi Arabia. You could look at Japan. You could look at the UK. What's it mean for all that?
Well, I didn't even know which one of these I was supporting as I was writing the book. It's incredibly difficult. And I think the most important takeaway from the book is that all three of these are actually doable choices for America. It's not as if I think independence is the only way to go. But your questioner asks a very important point, which is the obvious reality is that, you know, Israel doesn't support a two-state solution anymore. They don't need Palestinians in their labor force. They effectively exclude and have security now that keeps them out, means a third intifada can't be threatened. That has been American interests. So, I mean, does that mean that U.S.-Israel relations should be exactly the same as they used to be? Saudi Arabia used to be a major oil producer for the United States. U.S. in 10 years is going to be the world's largest oil producer. They don't need energy from the Middle East anymore. You know, when the Americans look at the Saudis are basically saying, hey, we want you to commit to us just like you have historically, maybe even more because it's more dangerous now. I mean, when interests change dramatically between two countries that are allies, should the alliance stay exactly the same? Or should you double down on it because your ally can't do as much? Those are the kinds of tough questions that need to be answered if you're going to take a real choice between an indispensable approach, a moneyball approach, and an independent approach.
And Ian Bremmer says, make it independent. Bring it home. Make this country work right. Brooke in Bluffton, South Carolina. Brooke, thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom, thank you. He actually was just kind of getting onto my question, but I'm wondering, I highly doubt that most Americans could even, like, realistically decide this choice, because I question whether or not what we hear from the media, what we see going on all the time, is really skewing our view of kind of what our place in the world should look like. And so just speaking with people that I know from, like, the Netherlands or other European countries, and they ask me questions like, why do you think the way that you do? Why are you wanting to be involved in those kinds of things? And that's the kind of stuff that I wonder too, and I'm curious if your guest thinks that Americans are even educated enough on the issues unbiasedly to be able to make a choice about where we should stand.
Brooke, I really appreciate your call. Ian, we heard the Marines ad there, they're recruiting, you know, we run toward tyranny and chaos. And Brooke says, essentially, we're so kind of mentally massaged in that direction that she's not sure Americans can turn it around and go toward the independent, bring it home path that you prescribe.
Well, she's right to focus on the media and even the disaggregation of the media. If people like decide who they're going to follow on Facebook and the rest, and they not only follow the New York Times, but they'll only follow the few people that they're writing that they really already agree with. So you're seeing so much more disaggregation and not a dialogue among different types of political views in America, and never mind Fox versus MSNBC. But what's interesting is when you talk about foreign policy is an area that, despite the fact that our Congress is completely dysfunctional and Washington's all broken, foreign policy is an area where the president can actually decide things, can actually move them forward. And foreign policy, despite all the partisanship that exists in America right now, you can look across the political spectrum and the Democrats and Republicans, and you can find hawks and you can find doves. And, it, you know, it's not a left versus right divide. The Republicans internally and the Democrats are easily as incoherent amongst themselves as they are against each other on foreign policy. It's not like health care. It's not like, you know, sort of the gap between rich and poor in the United States.
But you want to bring it home. Then it's not foreign policy anymore. Then it's domestic policy. Make the strongest case for this independent, bring it home path, Ian. We've got a minute left with you before we go to Ian McEwan, the great novelist. Make your case. It's where you come down.
The strongest point you can make is that the United States remains the country that at the end of the day everyone wants to invest in and live in, and you don't want to undermine that by incoherent international affairs that actually unnerve more than they support and that increasingly recognize a lift that the American people themselves over the long term will not support. I love the idea of indispensable America if we'll be committed to it. I fear that we won't be. And the worst thing you can do to your allies and your adversaries is say that you're going to take a strong role and don't live up to it. That's much worse than being coherent from day one.
And if we come home and get our house in order, then what?
Well, then I think the strength, first of all, for the Americans to end up as much more of a leader internationally is there. You have the ability to build institutions on a stronger base. But also, ultimately, the big story against the United States globally is going to be China. The Chinese government is much more likely to end up aligned with the United States if they view America as the ultimate too-big-to-fail economy. That's what you want to ensure that Beijing feels.
Chinese have been sort of chortling over our train wreck in the last week. Is that what democracy makes? They ask. Ian Bremmer says, make it right. Make it enviable. And that may be the best foreign policy of all, not boots all over the place. The new book is Superpower, Three Choices for America's Role in the World. Ian Bremmer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Tom, really my pleasure.
In a moment, novelist Ian McEwan's advice for the graduates of 2015 to preserve free speech for future generations. This is On Point. Celebrated novelist Ian McEwan, author of Atonement, which became an Oscar-nominated film, and many more novels, spoke yesterday to graduates at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He spoke about free speech, quoting Voltaire, "I disapprove of what you say, but will defend to the death your right to say it." He called free speech the lifeblood, the essential condition of the liberal education that the graduates had just received, and urged them not to waver in defending it.
More broadly, the internet has, of course, provided extraordinary possibilities for free speech. And at the same time, it has taken us onto some difficult terrain. It has led to the slow decline of local newspapers and so removed a skeptical, knowledgeable voice from local politics. Privacy, also an essential element of free expression. The Snowden files have revealed an extraordinary and unnecessary level of email surveillance by government agencies. Another essential element of free expression is access to information. The internet has concentrated huge power over that access in the hands of private companies like Google, Facebook, and Twitter. And we need to be careful, vigilant, that such power is not abused. Large pharmaceutical companies have been known to withhold research information vital to the public interests. And on another scale, the death of a young black man in police custody could be framed as the ultimate sanction against free expression, as indeed is poverty and poor educational resources. All these issues need the input of men and women with a liberal arts education, and you, new graduates, are well placed to form your own conclusions. And you may reasonably conclude that free speech is not simple. It's never an absolute. We don't give space to proselytizing pedophiles, to racists, and remember, race is not identical to religion, or to those who wish to incite violence against others. Wendell Holmes' hypothetical shouting fire in a crowded theater is still relevant. But it can be a little too easy sometimes to dismiss arguments you don't like as hate speech, or to complain that this or that speaker makes you feel disrespected. Being offended is not to be confused with a state of grace. It's the occasional price we all pay for living in an open society. Being robust is no bad thing. Being robust is no bad thing. Either engage with arguments, not with banishments, and certainly not with guns, or, as an American Muslim teacher said recently at Friday prayers, ignore the entire matter. In making your mind up on these issues, I hope you'll remember your time at Dickinson and the novels you may have read here. It would prompt you, I hope, in the direction of mental freedom. The novel as a literary form was born out of the Enlightenment, out of curiosity about and respect for the individual. Its traditions impel it towards pluralism, openness, a sympathetic desire to inhabit the minds of others. There is no man, woman, or child on earth whose mind the novel cannot reconstruct. Totalitarian systems are right with regard to their own narrow interests when they lock up novelists. The novel is or can be the ultimate expression of free speech. So I hope you'll use your fine liberal education to preserve for future generations the beautiful and precious, but also awkward, sometimes inconvenient, and even offensive culture of freedom of expression we have. Take with you these celebrated words of George Washington. If the freedom of speech is taken away, then dumb and silent, we may be led like sheep to the slaughter. We may be certain that Dickinson has not prepared you to be sheep. Good luck, 2015 graduates, in whatever you choose to do in life.
Novelist Ian McEwan speaking to graduates at Dickinson College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania yesterday. For a video and transcript of his full speech, go to our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Nick Anderson, Catherine Brewer, Abigail Collins, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Stefano Katsonis, Sarah Platt, and James Ross, with help from Araz Havan and Caitlin O'Keefe. Welcome today to producer Abby Ruzica. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.